Then the thrones, that's the next, are the service angels, or the footstool of God. They're depicted as many with many eyes and serve as the wheels for the chariot of God. They're said to have been assigned the task of fulfilling the justice of God, which is why they are called the thrones. Their power lies in humility. Although they are said to shine as brightly as a seraphim and caravan, their humility allows them to be objectively pass judgments on behalf of God. And it, basically what the thrones are is they're the ones who communicate the knowledge of the higher ranks of angels down to the lower ranks. The second hierarchy, so we've got the first hierarchy, which has the three rings, and then we have another second hierarchy, which is going to have another three rings. This group is known as the rulers, the governors, and the guiding agents of the planets. That's what the theology and some theory was in the medieval period. A point in fact, the angels guide the planets in their orbits and things of this sort. The first is the dominations. They represent God's power and carry out the commands of God. They are administrators who are depicted wearing green and gold outfits and carry both a sword and a scepter. They regulate the work of the other angels and keep a close watch on even the most intimate small details of existence. So in other words, they're the administrators. The angels above are principally about knowledge, and they communicate and love, and they communicate that to that knowledge to the lower, that to the thrones. The thrones then turn around and they execute that knowledge. That's their job. They're administrators who say, okay, you guys go do this. The next is the principalities. And these signify leaders. They're the ministering angels and protectors of rulers. So what this means is that when someone becomes president or they become a king or something like that, an angel from the rank of principality is assigned to take care of him and to protect him. Sometimes referred to as the authorities, they are said to have the task of waging war against the demons. They guard the paths between heaven and earth and assist humans in resisting temptation. Some hold that Lucifer is said to have been of this choir, but in point in fact, he was actually the highest, not of a lower rank. The powers is the next rank. So there's the dominations, principalities, and powers. These were commissioned to remove the obstacles which interfere with God's commands. They are said to look out on the goings-on in cities, towns, houses. So God actually will assign an angel to your house, to your family sometimes, and any structure that contains humans. They are said to be given fairly frequent permission to deal one-on-one with mortals. They hold the power to move the hearts and minds of humankind when deemed necessary. They tend to aim for guiding and regulating the ideas of world leaders for maximum results. Okay, so that's their real function. Okay, so it's kind of, you've got the administrators and the people who guide in the middle. Then you've got the people who actually do the work. So it's all like management. You've got the guys who really know what's going on. Then you've got the administration. And then you've got the guys who actually executed, the guys in the field. Which sometimes they're not distinct as far as the guys who know what's really going on. At least in human beings, but in angels it's different. This third hierarchy is called the messengers of God. And the first rank is called the virtues. They exercise power over the material world, presiding over the laws of nature and maintaining order. They are also said to perform administrative duties similar to those of the dominations, but they are most specifically assigned to the details of our world and the cosmos. They are said to keep planets and stars moving in their proper order and looking after the weather on Earth. Now, the reality of that, the truth of that particular last part of that statement will become really clear when I talk about demons of the air later. They also are said to do a bit of work with bestowing character, such as valor and truth in the souls of mortals. They are the patron angels of the saints. In other words, there are some people that just get a higher angel than other people. All right. According to St. Thomas, they also regulate miracles as well. The next is archangels. They fulfill the important missions to man and preside over the governance of countries, cities, and dioceses. The most historical ambiguous of the angels, sometimes called the leaders of the entire angel command. In other words, we seem to know the least amount about them in a certain sense, although there's some particular ones within them that we know a lot about. But there's some of them that we don't know a whole lot about. But basically, they're the ones that kind of, they're the commanders in the field, so to speak, with the other angels. This stems from their original angel hierarchy, where they were only two types of angels. Some say that there's only really two classes, are angels and archangels. And traditionally, after St. Gregory the Great on, it was always distinguished between these nine choirs. And part of that is based upon the various statements stated in the Old Testament by St. Paul in his letters, how the thrones, principalities, or powers. So there's certain ways which we know that these are the actual names and their functions. They're field commanders in the field of battle against evil and the fallen angels under Satan's command. To mankind, they impart comfort, solace, and inner strength through the unconditional love, usually in the darkest moments. People of greater importance and who hold certain offices are assigned a guardian archangel. And this is very common, actually. So, for example, for a priest, he gets two guardian angels. He gets the ones that was assigned to him at the time in which he was created. And then, once he's ordained, he gets another one, which is actually very, very beneficial. And that some priests can make great use of, especially if there's people in their parish or under their pastoral care that are being attacked or suffer from some type of demonic influence. You can tell the guardian angel priest to go and protect this individual. One exorcist one time actually did that, and after the person contacted the exorcist and said, "This is what happened." There were four dark things around me, and then a bigger one came in and cleared them all out. So that's one of the signs that priests have a guardian angel, which is quite stout, so to speak. Then there are guardian angels. They watch over the spiritual and physical life of men and obtain gifts from God for them. They don't get a special name, although sometimes they're called the guardians or the guardian angels. But not every angel from that rank is a guardian. While all guardian angels initially are from that rank, not all of them that are in that rank are. Some of them deal with other things. They're said to focus on being caretakers for mortal humans. All guardian angels are from this class, except those pertaining to the offices or of those for individuals who have an extreme importance historically. If you could actually see a guardian angel, it would probably give you some kind of a clue about what God intended for your life. The number of angels. Considering that every person receives his own guardian angel, and that from the choir of angels there are more angels than there were assigned to men, so from the first rank, you have at least the number of angels which pertain to all the guardian angels of all the human beings that have ever existed, plus those that weren't assigned, plus those who would have fallen from that. That's just from your one rank. And then you have all the other ranks above that. It's pyramidal, so as you get up higher, there's less and less of them in each particular rank. That means that of the angels, there's probably in the order of hundreds of billions of them. They say, you can't put a number on it, you can't quite quantify it this way, but they say that the material created universe which we see only accounts for 5% of God's creation. That the angels actually constitute not the other 95%. Obviously, the number is questionable because you can't really set a number to them. And you can't compare a spiritual substance to an immaterial substance quantitatively in a certain sense. Okay. But the point is that there's far more of them than there are of us. The demons. They were once created in the state of grace, but they fell in the second instance and they were damned in the third. They lost all the power that pertains to the grace that they had, but none that pertains to their intellect and will. They're just as intelligent as they used to be. Now, human beings are different. Every time we commit a sin, we get dumb and stupid. And every time we do it, we get dumber. Okay. Whereas every time we do an act of virtue and do the right thing, the brighter we get. So, the moral to the story is that doesn't apply to demons. Their intelligence is not lost. Their infused knowledge is not lost. They still know everything that's going on. It's infused in them as things go on. They know everything. This is one of the reasons why you can tell someone's possessed. They're telling you things are going on in some other place, in some other room, and there's no way this individual could be there to know. Their intelligence is so far above ours that we stand absolutely no chance in relationship with them except by means of grace, which enlightens our minds above their knowledge. They do not have darkness of the intellect, again, as I mentioned, but they don't know future events. They don't know what God, as I said, is good, which graces he's going to give to a particular individual. They know some graces. There are some people who become possessed through no fault of their own because they're targeted by demons because that particular individual is to play a pivotal or a key role or a very important role in history. And so this is, they're just targeted individuals. And you can see it in their life, they're oppressed. Their life is just a disaster from the time it begins to the time it ends. Which usually means if your life is a disaster, you're probably supposed to be more important than you think you are. Which usually consoles people to some degree. Their wills are so powerful that the lowest angel could disintegrate the earth, or if God would allow it. They can kill us by a single act of will, but God, we know in the book of Job, said, do not touch his substance, which is a technical phrase for saying you cannot kill him. Only grace in our wills and the power of accompanying our prayers and good works can we overcome their will. The sin they commit was by rejecting their task. This means that that sin also constitutes their greatest weakness, their greatest shame, and their greatest humiliation. Their name is their assigned task. So if you can find out what their name is in an exorcism, that means you know what their weakness is. And that's why they don't want you having it. Second, to name a thing constitutes a form of authority. When Adam was brought all the things to name, it was to indicate, A, that look, this is all different from you. And it was partly done so that you would understand that when Eve was brought to him, okay, yeah, she's not like anything else. Okay. So there was that side of things. But it was also to indicate, to manifest his authority over them. It's why parents have the right to name their child, because they have a natural law authority over them. So once you have the name of somebody, there's a certain authority, because you can kind of add, you can get their attention to it, there's certain things that you can do with their name. Well, it's the same thing with demons. Once you have their name, there's a certain authority that you have over them. And that means once you know their name, you know their weakness, and you can beat them over the head with it. They possess all of the infused knowledge and doubt of their creation and continually see this infused knowledge. This is why dealing with them is extremely dangerous and requires an absolute abandonment to God, His grace, and providence. If you ever see a guy, if you ever see a priest who thinks he's going to deal with this on his own intelligence, he is doomed. In fact, if anything they'll tell you, exorcists will tell you, is that being an exorcist is one of the most humiliating works that you will ever do, because you're constantly getting bamboozled by them. Not in bad ways, and you just hope it doesn't harm people in the process. But God allows it for your humiliations to become more effective as an exorcist. It is false theology that you read from time to time, as I mentioned, they were uncertain. A battle continues in Abram after their creation, sometimes called heaven, but in fact, that is the Latin word is caelum. Caelum can have two different meanings. It can mean whatever's above us, which is the angels are always considered to be above us in some way, or it can actually be considered the place of the residence of God, which are two distinct things. At a certain point, God gave St. Michael the power to cast the demons out of the presence of the good angels who had the beatific vision at the third instance. Satan's humiliation is that his place in heaven was taken by a woman, and he was cast down by an angel of the second lowest rank. He was humiliated. His humiliation is the worst because he is the proudest, having been the highest. Okay, so hell for demons does not include the temporal punishment, except insofar as their wills are disordered. They suffer from pains of conscience. That's the only temporal side of their punishment. They principally suffer from pain of loss, which is, as soon as a person is judged, when you die and stand before God, one of the first things that's going to be communicated to you is your absolute need. An absolute need to see God face to face to be happy. And that is communicated to the angels, and that if you don't get that need fulfilled, that's called the pain of loss. If you get it fulfilled, that's called glory or heaven, the beatific vision. So they suffer from the pain of loss. One time an exorcist had Satan on the ropes, and in the conversation, which normally the exorcists are told, don't talk to him, just beat out of what you need to know, and that's it. But because they're very deceptive, and they can lead you down a path you don't want to go very quickly. But in the process, the exorcist asked Satan what his weakness, what his greatest suffering was, he couldn't see God. And the exorcist forced him to tell him, something about God is the most beautiful thing there is. And Satan said, I would be dragged up and down a barbed wire pole 1,000 times just to be able to gaze on God's, just gaze on God's face for an instant. So he knows exactly what it all is. Not all of them are allowed to get out of hell. So the demons are cast down into hell. Not all of them are allowed to get out. They get out, although today you might think they pretty much all of them got out. They get out of hell only by God's permissive will, either directly or indirectly. Now, by directly, it means that, you know, you can have the, you know, the book of Job. That line, if you know the Latin, it does kind of come out in the English, but it says, Unde venis. That's what God says to Satan, Unde venis. He's like, where did you come from? It's a slam. It's a total slam that, you know, you were created for something much higher for me, but look at you. It's basically what's being said to him. And, of course, Satan doesn't respond because he can't. But the point is that God allows him to come out to afflict Job. And that's a direct, a case of direct. And that happens from time to God. God will allow it in order to his glory because God likes beating up on demons. He enjoys them. Then it can be done indirectly. And this is done by man committing an evil that pertains to the particular task of a demon in hell. Now, what does that mean? It means that when you perform certain evil actions, you open the door to demons inserting themselves into your lives. That's basically what it means. When Adam and Eve fell, they came under the domination of Satan. Why? Because this is what happened. He indicated to them a role of leadership. Do this, or eat the apple. Which meant as soon as they ate the apple, they fell under his leadership or his authority and dominion, and therefore would be afflicted forever. Every time you sin, it increases demonic dominion over you. That doesn't mean you become possessed, doesn't mean you become obsessed or oppressed. It just means you open the door. Not every door that gets opened does God allow a demon in. But the fact of the matter is you open the door. And there are some people who become possessed by other people opening the door. Something which I'll say now, but I'll probably stress a little bit later. In my experience, 80% of women who are raped, through no fault of their own, obviously, become demonically obsessed. 80%. That's a pretty high statistic. And it's also the same case with molestation. It's a little bit less for some reason. It depends on the resilience of the individual. So I'll be talking more about the particular mechanism that opens the door in that case later and why it happens. But that's, you know, other people can do things that can open the door too. This is the biggest problem with witchcraft. And because it's on the rise, it's opening the door and we're just getting flooded with these things. Witchcraft in the past, I mean, people kind of like the same witch trials and people go, okay, now granted, that's not done in the proper manner. But the church from the beginning has always recognized that the involvement in witchcraft is a capital crime because of the sheer evil it unleashes on people. And it's if you ever actually have to deal with the fallout, you realize why the church has always thought it should be a capital crime. I mean, they wouldn't say that today, obviously. But historically, that's the way it was always viewed. Okay. We're going to stop there. I can answer a few questions. We'll take about a little break, I presume, and then we'll resume for the next conference. Yes?
Can I ask a question? All this information you've given, I've never found it anywhere in the Bible, and I'm no scholar or anything like that. So why do you suppose there wasn't a book in the Bible with all this stuff in it so that everybody could know it?
About 90% of it is. Principalities and powers, the various things. The fact that they actually were, that Satan, you know, he was a liar from the beginning. All of this.
But the
point is that about 90% of this actually is in Scripture. I just didn't give the citations. Otherwise, we'd be just thumbing through Bibles all night long. Part of it is also the fact that the church, through 2,000 years of history, has had intimate dealings with demons and angels and actually knows this stuff from contact and dealing with them. Because they tell them. You can, in an exorcism, you can actually beat out of them their rank, what their rank means, why they were given that particular assigned task. That's it. So it actually comes through the tradition. And the tradition is actually the more preeminent thing anyway from Scripture. So, because even Scripture is a piece of tradition, it's a monument. That's what most people don't realize. It's actually a part of tradition. It's just, you know, the apostles say, well, we don't have tradition in you. The minute you had a Bible to somebody, it's called the tradition passing out a monument to somebody. So, it's just which tradition you have to follow. Yes?
When he died, where did your guardian angel go?
He gets released and doesn't have to deal with you anymore. No. Yeah, that's actually it. He just goes back to heaven. And he actually meets you at your judgment. So, if you judged well. If not, he's just like, well, I'm trying. Yeah, that's actually, it's not really a rank.
It's a great little thing. I've never resolved that.
Yeah, the stuff I've read on it has never been clear enough sufficiently for me to actually give you an answer. I mean, I think it's kind of all over the map. What is the Nephilim, right? Yeah.
The number of places or seats in heaven that were lost by the demons, those are going to be replaced by the saints?
Yes. So man was created, part of the reason man was created is to fulfill. This hierarchy was a hierarchy of angels is a natural hierarchy. When they fell, but the amount of grace that they had is directly proportionate to their nature. They can't go up in grace or down in grace. Human beings, you know, you can have a little tiny old lady who's far holier than a big fat priest or, you know, a big tall priest or whatever. But the point is, so it doesn't matter about the particular nature of the individual with human beings, but with angels it's directly proportionate. When they fell, gaps, not in the natural hierarchy, they can't be replaced because God doesn't create angels to restore that particular part because if you did create that particular nature, there would be nothing to separate it from the demon that fell because they'd have the same nature. See, the reason why human beings, you can have a number of different human beings that have the same nature is because we have different bodies. It's our bodies that keeps us distinct from each other. Okay, well, angels aren't that way. So the natural hierarchy cannot be reconstituted, but the hierarchy of grace has these gaps. And God created created man to fill up the gaps in his heart, which means that God originally intended for you to reach a certain level. That's why St. Paul says, run to win the prize. So you, because there's these gaps, there's this particular level that you should strive for in that. And every time you commit a sin, every time you don't do what you're supposed to do, you fall short of that. So then what do? You create someone else to hog your spot. But the point is that you should be striving for the highest place possible because God gives you the amount of actual grace in your life proportionate to where he wants you to be in heaven. And so you should have absolute fidelity to grace, which means every single time he gives you that nudge, go pray, go do it. And then you'll reach that place you're supposed to. Every time you don't, you go down and someone else gets your place. So, yes?
In Lucian's life, you can't, by future, you know, marriage, you can't, like, you can't reach. If you lose a certain level of heaven, you can never do any more to get back to where you were.
You can. You can use super rogatory works, which will actually, they're works that are above and beyond your obligations and duties in life, and you can get back up there. So, yes? Yeah, well, it depends on which theologian you want to follow, actually. But your place in heaven is determined by how much sanctifying grace you have, ultimately. But your sanctifying grace is proportionate to a number of different things, the amount of charity you have, the excellence in virtue, the good works that you did, the meritorious works, that's what determines your place in heaven. And God had originally intended you to do certain works and certain things, and when you fail to do those, or when you commit sin, you detract from that which you were supposed to achieve. But you can do things above and beyond what you were supposed to necessarily have done, or what's required by your duties in your state of life. Super regulatory, that's above and beyond what we're obligated to do. And those works will actually give you a higher, will kind of restore you back up to that. When you commit a mortal sin, for example, and then you go to confession, the general opinion is that once you get back into the state of grace, the merits from your prior works revive. That is, you still get done back. There's a few who say they don't, but the majority of the theologians say you get all that merit back. So you are actually restored, in a certain sense, to that level of merit that you would have in the past. But you also have to recognize that when you die, and if there's any imperfections in your soul that you should have eradicated, that's going to detract a bit from that. You go to purgatory to get rid of them, but once you die, you can't make up for that. So, yes?
I'm in a servant where they want to remain your guardian angel. Mm-hmm. I really feel like that's an indicator. What
you're talking about, the remaining authority? The Vatican has forbidden people to do that.
There's
certain groups that actually have people name their guardian angel. And the Vatican has said, no, you can't do that. And there's a reason why you don't name your guardian angel. You don't have authority over him. He has authority over you, that's why you don't name him. He has to communicate. If he communicates his name to you, fine. But the problem is that you're, by trying to gain knowledge of something which isn't revealed to you, is a superstitious practice, and you can become influenced. So you have to be careful. That's one of the reasons I tell people stay away from that kind of thing. It doesn't mean you don't pray to your guardian angel regularly, obviously. But it just means, you know, you don't name him Fred or whatever. But, you know. Yeah.
In terms of life, if you get the name to write on the question, is that due to the
crime and also... It's due to a mechanism called disassociation, which I'll explain in a subsequent conference. So it's also a problem that many actors have. It's also a problem that children who are physically abused have, but that's something which we'll deal with. Yes?
So God is all-powerful and all-knowing, mm-hmm. and obviously he's the only one that's perfect, and he's the one that created the angels and demons.
Right.
And they've been around since before the time of man.
Right.
So why would he create the demons?
Knowing that they would fall?
Knowing that they would fall.
It's the same question, why would he create man knowing that he would fall? Because that's a good fight. No, it's actually because he creates people with free will and angels with free will, and what he really wants is to pack his house with people that love him. That's ultimately what you get into heaven for, is for loving him. So he created them knowing that they would fall, but that doesn't mean he's the cause. It just means that he accepted that because it meant that the people who would have to deal with evil people and demons and things of that sort would become holier and better people and be in a higher place and greater happiness in heaven than by if everything was all laid out. So it's really about glory. His glory is more perfectly manifest in you struggling against these things and becoming better. So God gets a certain glory even out of the demons because of the fact that, you know, he beats up on them and humiliates them. And that shows his perfect justice. So there is a certain reason for it. Not that he intended, not that he wanted that to happen, but when he allowed it to happen. So, yes.
Well, and I just made your angels now, but if you think a bit rude to say thank you, angels, can you ask them their name, or is that too forward?
That's too forward.
Okay.
Because normally speaking, the normal course of things is God doesn't reveal it to the particular individuals. So you shouldn't really be trying to seek after that knowledge because it's not necessary for your salvation. Ultimately, it's not going to help you. It might make you feel better, but that doesn't mean anything ultimately. Which you really should be doing, you can just name him, you know, my guardian angel. And I think that that's actually what God intends for most people is to not know. I mean, the actual names of people who know their guardian angels is very, very, very few. So, yes?
All the other demons that fell, are they from all nine of the choir?
Yes. All of the ranks lost members through damnation.
And did any of them, somebody told me one time to jail right out loud and something that they're
yes and no. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. That's something I'll deal with a little bit later in the other conferences. Because there's certain things they can figure out. There's certain things they can't. There's certain things that are hidden from them. There's certain things about what's going on in you that's revealed to them. There are certain times when people receive a particular grace from God, and that's revealed to the angels, to the demons. And, as I said, that's one of the reasons why they're targeted. But others, There's other things they don't know. That's something I'll talk a little bit more about in the other conference. Yeah.
With regard to exorcism and, you know, the exorcist giving the name of the demon and so on, information, how do they know that the demon is lying about his name?
Well, when it first says, you just keep beating on him until, because usually what will happen is you keep beating on him, he'll do one or two. Their psychology is very similar to ours, by the way. You know, they don't like a beating. So eventually, they might lie to you, and then you start beating on him, and they'll realize, okay, he didn't believe me, I got to tell him. And that's what's happened. And a lot of times, too, the exorcist will kind of know he's lying to him because there's other things surrounding it that give him an indication, and you tell me the truth. So you just beat up on them again for a while, and then if they're telling the truth, they'll be consistent. But if they're lying, they won't be consistent. It's just like human beings, when they lie, they're not consistent. So, yes.
The safest spot in the building was actually not very safe.
Well, that, yeah, the highest place in heaven is taken by our rain. So, okay. How long of a break do we want to take?
Sam will be back. Yeah. 8, so 15 minutes.
15 minutes, okay.